Hello and welcome to another episode of the Viva Bastardo Show, part of the Haggerty Podcast Network. Today we have Paolo Garella, who was head of the Pininfarina Special Projects in the early 90s. He worked almost exclusively with the Sultan of Brunei, making 40 to 50 extraordinary cars a year for the Sultan. Then he went on to do the Ferrari P45 with Jim Glickenhaus, and if that's not enough, he just started churning out the new Lancia Stratos. So let's get into it. I guess, well, do you want to start off by explaining to people all the kind of glorious and wondrous things you've done with cars? A little, give an executive summary? Or shall I ask you a peculiar question? It's your choice, Paolo.
Peculiar question.
Okay. I saw, excellent choice. I saw in an interview you did, you spoke about the idea of when you first became enraptured with cars. And you talked about going to the Turin car show in 1980, and you saw this Ferrari Pinin, and I thought to myself, that's a very strange car for someone to make a young... How old were you, if I may ask, in 1980?
Oh, no, I'm not going to answer to this question.
Okay, well, that will... Okay, but it seems to be like, generally speaking, when boys, when young men go to car shows, they fall in love with, you know, a two-door sports car with a 12-cylinder and exhaust and this. And instead, you fell in love with this very unusual, quite beautiful, four-door Pininfarina design sedan. So what was it... That's an unusual choice to fall in love with. What was it about that car that made you fall in love?
I think that there were a number of things. First, it was unusual, and I love unusual things. And this was something that was completely out of the scheme, completely out of anything that was existing at that time. Second, I think a big part was how the car was displayed. I remember that it was put on a stage, was high, lights, everything around was dark. So it was really the diva of the show. And then last, there were some technical details that probably, I don't know how many people noticed them, but the flash of the windscreen with the A-pillar, the flash of the A-pillar with the side door, how all of this was going around. It's me. Sorry.
What happened?
I can't believe it.
Are you getting a delivery of some food?
It's my phone.
Oh. That's fine, man. It's fine.
And so this, all this was creating a sort of magic atmosphere, but certainly the fact that this car was so unusual, so different, this was really what sparked my mind and I would say my decision. But I say, well, this is what I want to do when I grow up, So
there's something kind of magical. There's something magical. Well, you did do it, and you did it in an extraordinary fashion. I mean, so just for people who don't know who you are and what you've done. You started off as a testing engineer at Goodyear. Is that right?
Yeah, correct. That was my first job, and my first idea was not to work in Italy, and I moved to I only looked for jobs abroad, and I went to Luxembourg, and I did 5 years was test engineers in
Can I ask?
In Goodyear, it was a great time.
Can I ask why you wanted to escape Italy?
But for a number of reasons. Why? The first reason was because I believe that it was important at my age and how the world was developing to have an international background. Second, from a family point of view, my father traveled a lot. So for us in the family, travel to go abroad has always been seen as a very positive step. Third, I thought that, especially in that time, we're talking middle of the 80s, it was there were a lot of very interesting options and the possibility abroad. And the size of the company abroad was much bigger than the size of the company in Italy. So I thought that it was interesting to have an experience abroad. And honestly, when I went, I had no clear idea if yes or not I would come back to Italy. But eventually I did. But
so what is it? What is a testing engineer? I have no idea what that means.
Well, it was. I remember that time a little bit as we were the top gun of the testing guys in Goodyear. The group was called VLME. It means Vehicle Liaison Manufacturing Engineering, something like that. And we were basically testing the tires to completely subjectively to judge if they were good enough to be submitted to the car manufacturers. So, for example, one of the big big project I did was for the Tema Ferrari. So we were testing, I don't know, 4, 5, 6, 7 different tire construction. And subjectively, we had to say if it was good enough or in which area, comfort handling, noise, etc., they had to be improved. So it was quite, let's say, challenging because on some cars we had terrible problem to be approved. On others, like the at that time there was the Uno Turbo. I don't know if you remember.
Fiat Uno. Yeah,
it was unbelievable. For example, for that car, we developed an incredible tire that still today is remembered in Fiat for the performance it had. It was incredible.
So let me ask you this: how do you go from testing tires at Goodyear? And this is the thing, one of the parts of your career that obviously is of great interest. I'm utterly fascinated. How do you go from there to running special projects at Pininfarina, in particular, for the Sultan of Brunei, who's kind of like the grand wizard of car collectors?
Well, there has been a very small intermediate step, but very, very important for my career. I had a friend in Torino, and he was running a small company. It was called PTI Albatech, and the name of the gentleman is Giorgio Stirano. And when I decided for a number of also family reasons to come back to Italy, I went to him and he said, well, you know, I really would like to have you. I don't know if I can afford you, but it would be nice if you can join me. And I did. It was hard from a financial point of view, but in those years, I am talking 89, 92, all the coach builders in Torino, they were presenting incredible show cars, dream cars, and especially they were real. So there was a stronger demand in creating from scratch chassis and platform. And we became quite a leader on that in Torino. And on the top, we were doing race car, we were doing electric car, we were doing buses, we were doing a number of things, never earning a penny.
What were you doing for those, in that context, what were you doing? Were you designing? Were you conceptualizing the cars? Were you kind of drivetrain? What were you specifically?
We were doing the running chassis for all those cars. Okay. So just to name a few, we did the Nazca for Giugiaro, first full carbon fiber chassis. We did at the end 5 of those. By the way, 2 of them, they ended up in Brunei. We did the Etos. So we did for Pininfarina, we did the Etos 1, the Etos 2. for Bertone, we did the chassis of the Nivola, the Blitz. We did, again, for Ital Design, the Columbus, incredible car. All things like that. You know, at that time, there was Geneva every year. So there was a really big request on those things. Then when I left, one of the last projects we did was the Alpha 155 for the, I think it was called the D2. So it was not the DTM, it was the small one. And the first year I joined the company, I follow the Group C championship. So let's say on 3 years after that I stayed there, I did, I don't say 100, but tens of project of chassis development. It was incredible because we use aluminum, we use carbon fiber, and it was very rich from a intellectual point of view. This brought me into Pininfarina.
By any chance, you didn't work on the Maserati Barchetta that was done in 1990 that then turned into the De Tommaso Guerra? I only ask because I have a personal interest in that car, because I own that car, so I'm trying to track down its history.
It's fantastic. It's a fantastic car. I refer to that car a lot of time to my engineers. No, we did a project for, you know, at that time there were three, four big companies in Torino, and one was IDEA, the IDEA Institute, and they were working a lot for Fiat, and for them we did a mule on a Maserati B-Turbo, and we did a new rear suspension with five links, that was a mule for the famous in Torino Alfa Romeo coupe that was never built. That was the coupe that should have taken the V10 of the 164, the Group 5, the you remember there was one was built one or two 164. It was built by Brabham, I think.
When you talk about the Biturbo, we actually share some very common cars, because when you mentioned Biturbo, my heart sings, because I happen to currently own a Maserati Shamal, Now, are you laughing because it's a terrible car, or because it's a great car?
Because from what I heard, it's quite challenging to start. So I don't know how many times I have used it.
Really? I've never had any problems with that car.
I don't know. Yeah, well, they were quite famous for not being able to start for months. So.
Okay, so I'm very in the cars I own, or the cars I have owned, I've been very intrigued by things that people have forgotten or things that are unusual. So that's why I like the Ditto, I have a Guara, etc. Anyway, but... okay, so you jump from this company to Pininfarina.
Yes.
And tell me about the Sultan of Brunei. I'm sure you get asked this all the time, but I feel like you were at a place in time and history working with an individual, and it's almost like a Medici of cars in the way that the Medici's kind of funded artists. Can you talk a little bit about the relationship with the Sultan of Brunei and you and Pininfarina? Because that's just a mesmerizing story.
I don't know how many hours you can record.
Well, maybe you could do the highlights. I know, for instance, there's some of your sort of most interesting and unusual stories to do. I know that, for instance, he was very interested. He really loved the 456, the Ferrari. Before I start, why don't you just explain what happened with the Sultan Brunei? And you explained to everyone what was happening.
But when I joined Pininfarina in 1992, the company was already working for the Sultan. since a few years. They already delivered the three Mythos, and they already delivered the F90. Plus, they were building a number of Cabrio bays on the Bentley Turbo R. All this was very vague, and nobody was really had really an understanding of the place and what was going on, because we were selling the car through the Ferrari
dealer
of Singapore. Okay, now it happened that literally a few days after me joining Pininfarina, the guy comes from Pininfarina, and there were some strange things going on. Our feeling was that the guy wanted to leave Pininfarina and join Ital Design, so to start to have special car built by Giugiaro. Probably is the first time in my life that I am telling this story. So,
oh, fantastic!
So the guy comes to us, and we delivered just before my arrival. We delivered, I think, some right and drive F40, you know, or some Bentley, and this guy from Singapore came and was very hard and on me, because I was the last one arriving, and say, if you don't fix this car, we're going to be a big problem for you and for Pininfarina, and you're going to lose the business. So I was scared to death. And they say, if you continue like this, I'm going to give your phone number to the head of the garage, and you will have to talk with him directly to him. I say, oh my God, that's bad. And actually he did. And it was his biggest mistake, because the guy called me, and I was able, in a time where we had no internet, we had only phone and fax, not working very well with Braille, I was able on the phone to fix with him an F40. And I became a hero.
Sorry, when you say fix, you mean like mechanically fix it?
Yes, because they had this F40 that was stuck in the lower position with the front suspension. Okay, the F40 was the first car of the latest F40 that they had a lifter to the front suspension. It was hydraulic, and if you would not use the car for long, the system was not able to bleed himself. So you had to do a short circuit on the relay, and the car would raise again. So I did this on the phone with this guy. The name was
just to be clear, the guy you were talking to, he was the guy who was head of the Sultan of Brunei's garage.
Yes,
I see.
Yes.
Okay,
and I was able to fix it, and apparently I became a hero, and Few days later, I receive a phone call of this guy saying, come down, because we want a direct deal with you. We don't want to go through this man anymore.
As in come down to Brunei.
To Brunei, right. Yes. And so at that time, I had a great friend. He was the commercial director of Pininfarina. He took the plane. He didn't fly through Singapore because he was afraid that some spy could say, let the dealer know. So he flew through Malaysia and went to Brunei and made this deal. But when he came back with I don't know how many millions of orders of cars. Because he said, I want this, I want three of this, I want three of this, and by the way, I want this, this, and that. And
this is just so amazing, because of course this is every car person's dream, is to have Pininfarina. Just so, was it a list like, I want five Bentleys, I want five F40s, I want six Testarossa, but and then designed this way or that way, or was it kind of a little bit open-ended in terms of what Pininfarina could do?
Let's say at the beginning it was I love this car, make me a right hand drive of this. For example, the first fix order we received was to transform in right hand drive 3288 GDO. Okay. Then the 456 came out, and he became crazy about 456. In between, he asked us to redesign the Bentley Continental, the Continental R. Okay. He had already ordered to Bentley, I don't know how many of these cars, but there was, again, the four-door, there was the long wheelbase, there was the estate, etc. And he ordered to us what then they were called the B2 and the B3, and that we did in the B3 in, I think, 13 pieces, and the B2, 18 pieces.
But did they give you, did he give you freedom to design, or was he very specific, like, I want it to be, you know?
No, basically, old. We came down every time. But, you know, I have to think that every 2 months I was going there together with the commercial director. We were bringing renderings, and we had a, so every time we had a...
In those days, were renderings, were they drawings?
Drawings.
Yeah, okay. And would you bring little models or just drawings?
No, drawings. Okay. Drawings. And, you know, the name of the cars, like B2 and B3, is because there were every rendering, or say every set of rendering had a code. So there was the B1, the B2, the B3, and so he chose the B2 and the B3.
Right. Wasn't there some story with the B? I can't remember. It was a Bentley two-door or four-door? Wasn't there a story where you brought the car down there and it was for his birthday and it was raining and the car was wet and they had to change this? Do you remember that story?
Oh yes, you know, you're very well informed.
I've been watching you, Paolo, watching you.
That was the first B2. It was a green car with a green interior, and was delivered for the birthday party of Prince Jeffrey. So it was the first big present of Prince Hakim to Prince Jeffrey, and. The car arrived in the garage completely covered in moisture because the difference in temperature between the plane and the humidity and the place was such that it would immediately be full inside everything of water. That was terrible. So we brought the company to the car to the garage. We open everything, we dry everything, and then we rush to, they took the car, they rushed to the party. And while he was driving, Prince Hakim speak with the chief of the car and say, well, the steering wheel is not straight. And so we jump on the Mercedes of this guy, and we go to this palace. And the car was parked in the front of the palace with a very nice, rights of Prince Hakim on the dash, etc. And the chief of the garage, his name was Jeremy. It was Chinese, and Jeremy Lim, and this guy jumping into the car and start to dismantle the steering wheel. And in this moment, when everything was in pieces, the door opened and Prince Jeffrey with Prince Hakim, with the family, everybody comes out. So literally myself and my friend, we were hiding against a pillar.
So you couldn't be seen. You were hiding behind the pillar.
Yeah. And our mechanics was like a snake. It was disappearing, and Prince Hakim became furious and he wanted to fire Jeremy because he said, you're crazy, I ask you to leave, but you don't. So big things. But the car was a big success. So because the first order, they were always three. Okay, they were starting always with three. And then they were ordering more and more and more, in three, so 3, 6, 9, 12.
But didn't you end up doing between 40 and 60 cars a year for the Sultan?
Yes, well, roughly we're doing between 50 and 60 cars per year.
I mean as your relationship continued, was he allowing you more and more creative freedom in terms of design?
In terms of design. It has always been very free. I think that we, in our, let's say, with the time, every manufacturer or let's say every supplier took a special position. Okay, so Pininfarina, because it was a coach builder and didn't have their own chassis, it was seen as the bodybuilder for everybody. So actually we did car based on Bentley, Rolls Royce, Aston Martin, Ferrari, AMG. In certain case, Prince Akin was coming to us asking to improve what he thought in the car was not okay. One of the best projects we did was the Jaguar J, because he loved the XJ220, but basically nobody could fit in the car, and it was very uncomfortable, and he wanted to have something nicer, more comfortable. And so we designed this this car that for me was one of the really of the best of the project we did. The car was more aerodynamic of the X220. We put a Group N engine with 650 horsepower. We put a semi-automatic transmission developed together with ProDrive. So it was
do you know that I actually own an XJ220?
Yeah.
Did you? I'm not having any luck. I have all these cars. The Shamal doesn't start. The X220 is uncomfortable. I'm not having any luck with you.
But listen, tell me, it's true that when you change the gear with the XJ220, your finger, you cut your finger against the console.
No, I would actually say
What do you mean? No.
No.
They stay in the garage.
No. I oddly enough, I find the 220 both supremely comfortable and, funnily enough, remarkably easy to use. Like the gear shift is a delight to use. I mean, it is weird that it's such a big car, and then when you get inside, you think, "Where's all the space gone?" That's totally true. But I do find it. I haven't had the finger slicing problem that you mentioned.
No, well, come on. You don't have a real XJ220.
I have tiny hands. Maybe that's the thing. So I know that, for instance, he was, as you say, he was really fast. He loved the 456. Didn't he make like 50 or 60 different variations? And wasn't there a 456 you guys made with night vision?
Two, yes.
Can you talk a bit about the night vision 456?
Oh, yeah. To give you the impression of the size of the success of the 456, we deliver in the different form, we deliver 42 cars. Two of them, they were this night vision. There was a first night vision that was, let's say, not as extreme. The second one was really, just to give you an idea, the back of the car, so all the trunk was full of computers, okay, for that time. Basically, the car had six cameras around the car, two of which they were mounted on the roof on a system that was movable. It had to make it night vision. We had infrared illuminator fit in the bumper. there were five screens in the car, completely interchangeable. So you could put what the camera was seeing in any of the screens. Plus, you had let's say things that today probably you find in a Fiat 500, but for that time they were quite unique. For example, we had a red dot in a white screen that was moving with the acceleration. We had everything.
But Paolo, can I ask what was the? Oh, sorry. Go on.
The most nice thing that we did, that was my idea. We had the roof, Imperiale, the interior, was illuminated with fiber optic, and on the head of the prince and the passenger, there was the logo of the prince that was lighting up when you would open the door. Okay, that was amazing. That was something. Now there is some manufacturer that is trying to copy us, but not yet at that length.
Can I ask what was the reason for the night vision 456s to drive without headlights?
Yes, but at the end, you know, many of those things they didn't have a real meaning of use. It was just something for us. It was very interesting because every time was a technical challenge. Okay. For them over there, it was just fun. It was just a very big, let's say, like Girodon Park at the end was an amusement park, and those cars were part of it. But I just want to come back to what you said at the beginning. I think that in the automotive business, not many people understand the importance of that client in the early 90s because he actually saved Aston Martin, he saved Rolls-Royce and Bentley. And through the connection that the different president and CEO of the company made in Brunei, many of the big deals of buying and selling those cars were made. So it was crazy, but it was absolutely technical. The push that we received, for example, in developing automatic transmission, in developing semi-automatic transmission, was not there at that time in the market, and is, I mean, thanks to them and the money that they invest in those things that became big things. The first car we did were the Ferrari 355. And I can tell you that when you would have drive that car with the automatic transmission, you would never go back to the manual shift. So I have a lot of respect for them for what they did at that time.
That's so interesting. I never really thought of it that way, because you always think of the Sultan of Brunei as this person who had extraordinary wealth and the ability to order up innumerable cars any way he saw fit. But as you say, the idea that he was in a way pushing forward research that would not have been funded at the time, and then that sort of expanded out in the industry. That's a fascinating thing to think about.
But if you take many of the cars that were built for them became product, and many of those products, the company would not be able to fund. For example, right. If you take the Azure has been a project at the beginning, was a project only for them.
So the Azure was what was that car, the Azure? Oh, the Bentley Azure.
The Bentley Azure.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. The Bentley Azure, Bentley, didn't have the money to do a convertible on the Continental R. It was only thanks to this dealer in Singapore, or the dealer in Singapore, that had the idea to put together Pininfarina and the Bentley to build the car. And then the car was created. Theoretically, at the beginning, was only six cars, a six-car program, and then it became a big success for Bentley. There was another program that was called the Java. The Java was done in the late 90s, was one of the last projects. And that guy was a coupe, four-door, and those were Bentley built on the chassis of the BMW. So it was the first Bentley built on the chassis of the BMW, like, and also the SUV that they built, the Bentley beat was the, I don't remember the name, the code name now, but that was built on a chassis of a Land Rover. Branded Bentley, and that was the first SUV that we know. So they were, their ideas and their let's say the request to the manufacturer was but also something that probably nobody knows, but they have been the first one to ask and to invest in making matte painting. Matte paint,
right? They is in the Sultan.
Yes, right. Yes, and their request was so strong, and the money behind was so big that the company would happily invest and develop new things for them.
Oh, this is so fascinating, Paolo. This is so interesting. This idea that they basically funded R&D for companies that couldn't afford the R&D to create models that once they were out and in the world, other people go, oh, you know what? There's a Bentley Azure convertible. I would like one. And then it becomes possible for these companies to capitalize off this free R&D that they've received at the hands of the Sultan of Brunei. That's amazing.
Yes.
How interesting.
It was amazing. Amazing time.
Yeah. Are there any other Brunei cars that spring to mind that were of particular interest to you?
But I think that for us in Pininfarina, there is something else that was very, very important at that time. Probably nobody remembers because we had a lot of crises since then, but certainly in Italy, beginning of the 90s was not an easy moment for the automotive business. And I'm very proud to say that we made certain activities, for example, the hand beating of panels, and certain company in Torino surviving only because of the Sultan of Brunei. We made a decision in Pininfarina. We didn't grow the company. We didn't grow Pininfarina too much. But outside, the network outside Pininfarina that was working for them were more than 400 people at that time. So really, it helped the economy of Torino in a great way at that time.
That's interesting.
Having said that, I think that the best, one of the most iconic car we built was the 456 Estate and the four-door.
That's fantastic. I mean, look, I've always been a huge fan of the 456. I have to say that personally, I feel like Ferrari hasn't made very many beautiful cars in the last 20 or so years. But for me, the 456... was really an exquisite design. And then the Estate, or Shooting Brake, as they would probably call it here, is glorious, that thing. How come Ferrari... go on.
No, please.
Well, I wish they had just taken the Sultan Brunei and your lead and created a whole series of 456 Shooting Brakes, because it's a perfect car for that design.
Yeah, no, we... At that time, the relation was different. Basically, there was no involvement at all of Ferrari in what we were doing. And everything was going through Sergio Pininfarina and Gianni Agnelli. Basically, Sergio Pininfarina was going to Mr. Agnelli, was showing a couple of renderings and say, well, you know, I'm doing... I say, oh... You're very lucky to have this client, Gianni Agnelli.
That was it. That was the approval. Is Agnelli going, oh, you're a lucky man, and he'd go ahead. He gave me the papal blessing.
Yes. So like this.
That's fascinating. That is. I mean, it's kind of extraordinary to hear of how. I guess it was a much less corporate world in a way. Ferrari was not so corporate as they are now, and things were easier possibly.
Yes, at that time were easy. And then things at the end, they became, honestly, I used to say everything finished around 97. At that time, and still the relation was very good. Sergio Pininfarina was still active in the company. So in the relation with all the Ferrari staff was probably different than what happened after. But the 456... I, you know, those cars, there is one car that is touring the world, and now telling me is in US, but the level of engineering and the quality of that car was incredible. It was like a production car. And a nice story also is that this car was in England, was bought by a gentleman in England, and he contacted me to have the car basically refurbished. So I took the car to Torino, and we repainted the car and we retrimmed the car. And it was again the moment in which I was responsible for a special project, and I arranged everything to go and collect Jim Glickenhaus that was coming by plane. And I drove him with that car from Caselle to Pininfarina.
Okay? In the 456 and, shooting break.
In the 456 for shooting break, yeah. Yes. And and years later, he told me, well, you know, that car made me understand what is when you do a one-off or when you do a special car. It was not a kit car. It was not a car put together with a nice style. It was a real car. And I give you a number. That car, the estate, had the same weight than the coupe. Huh. So we were really doing things at very, very high level.
I have one side question is, how can I squeeze a car out of the Sultan of Brunei's connection? Do you have any people that you can? I just need one or two, man. I just need one or two, Paolo. I didn't. Yeah. He won't even notice. We could just push them out into a truck at night. That leads me to the next thing I'd love to talk to you about, of course, which is the P45.
Because
it's such a
first one or the second?
Well, not the competizione. Because it's such an interesting story. So would you like to talk about that a little bit? Because it's obviously people know what that is. A Ferrari P45 based on a 3-4 Ferrari P34 whatever it is, but it's utterly beautiful, this thing.
I think that but that car certainly means a lot for me, because after the time of doing all the car for the Sultan, I had 3-4 years in Pininfarina in which I was involved in something completely different. I was working on the restructuring of the engineering part business of Pininfarina, and when we finished this with my team, I asked Andrea to go back to the root of the company and create again one-off and special project. I have to be honestly that the beginning was not easy, was not funny, because we thought that a good step would be to do a small series, to do 20 cars, 30 cars like this. And at the end, that approach was, let's say, turned out to be a disaster. So I was really, really under a lot of pressure from the company to try to do and demonstrate that was that still the idea was good. And so I work with a number of consultants to try to get to these people, to collectors and to people that eventually would build a one-off with Pininfarina. We started with 650 names, okay? And out of 650 names, through the years, we got 4 contracts, okay? It's very interesting, the dynamic, what happened, why, etc. But the first contract that we signed was with Peter Karikov in New York for a 612 for the Kappa. And the second one, really literally few weeks after, was with Jim. I met Jim the first time in Villa d'Este. And the person that was introducing me to him said, well, you know, I have a good news and a bad news. The good news is that you will meet him. The bad news is that he just bought a 412P. So I think that he will not do anything for a few months or a few years. And actually, it was not true. We sat down, we had some rendering from Jason Castriota.
Hang on, we should just explain who Jason is. I actually know him vaguely. Jason, he's a car designer, young guy at the time. Was he head of design at Pininfarina at the time? Or
no,
or just a designer?
He has never been head of design at Pininfarina. Okay. He was a designer, with a lot of talent, and he had a very, very successful period. A little bit of a crazy horse in some moment, but he loved this idea of doing special project and something that was important for those strange reasons in life. He loved the P3s, P3, P4, etc. And his dream was to do a car like this, okay, to reinterpret that car.
Was that something Glickenhaus was interested in, or he had nothing in his mind at the time in that context?
No, Jim had the idea of doing a car, but he had more the idea of doing a replica.
I see.
So he had in mind the idea of doing a replica, maybe with a new technology, but a replica. So I explained to him, clearly based on what we did on Brunei, all the process, the style process, the engineering, etc. And I convinced him to do it to use an Enzo to do the car.
I mean, that in and of itself, Paolo, is kind of an amazing thing. Like to say, okay, we're going to take an Enzo, which is the peak of Ferrari cars at that time, and get rid of the body.
That's it.
I mean, that's a ballsy thing to do.
But I have a lot of respect from Jim, because I think at that time he has been the only one with that courage. After P45, things changed, but during all the development, because he was posting picture on Ferrari chat, etc. The majority of the people were saying, oh, you are crazy, what you are doing, the Enzo, you should not dare to touch it. So let's say the public and the general common sense was, you are crazy, you should not do something like that.
I'm just trying to figure out the timeline. So you did. He wanted to do a replica. Then did Jason and you and Jason approach him, say, here's this idea that Jason has for this P45. It's kind of a reinterpretation, the original P3. And then he looked at it and was like, oh, this is fantastic. Or was it a hard sell? Or was he in love with it immediately?
Well, you know, there is something that I always love with Jim, is that he trusts people. It's like He understands that there might be people in the room that have a better idea of what he has. And certainly when you show him that there is a potential, that there is something new, he is brave enough to say, okay, let's take the brave way. And this happened with him also when we did SCG-003. He was more, let's say, leaning toward a more mild style, and I push him to go in this direction. At the end, we did 003, and was the right decision. In the case of P45, Jason came up with some very, very, say, strong rendering. And from there started a process typical of Pininfarina to make it, I would say, less strange, okay? Taking everything a little more on the line. But definitely P45 is coming from the pen of Jason. It's, I think, his baby. And so we started the production, and then we were on the lawn of Pebble Beach with both car with the car of Peter Karikov and the one of Jim.
I feel like when those two, the 612, the Calico 612 makes the P45, I think that it's almost like the 612 never existed. But I mean, it's a beautiful car, but the P45 is this extraordinary thing. I mean, you have to have no soul to not fall in love with that car. So what?
Yes,
what,
tell me about.
I was going to say, just ahead. What the. So, okay. So, the process you show Jim the rent, Jason, you show the rent, the idea of P45 to Jim. You kind of, it goes through the Pininfarina process. It becomes what it is. It takes, how long does it take to build it roughly?
15 months.
Okay. And then you do this great unveiling. Pebble Beach, was it, did you say?
Pebble Beach,
yeah.
Yes.
And then what? Where's Ferrari in all of this?
Well, Ferrari was connected twice on this. First, because the era of Sergio was finished and Andrea was running the company. And the relation between Sergio and Montezemolo and Andrea Montezemolo were very different. So I sold the car to the project to Jim without the Ferrari brand, but with the Pininfarina brand. There were some pictures coming out with the Pininfarina brand on the bonnet and people commenting, saying, "Ah, oh, how you dare? This is Ferrari. Are you crazy to put." Actually, this was true. I mean, we sold the car as a Pininfarina. Then for a number of reasons, there was a certain situation was created between Pininfarina and Montezemolo more than with Ferrari. And at that time, we had the style model of the P45 finish. And so Andrea told me, it's the right moment to ask a favor to Montezemolo. And so Montezemolo came, and we went on the roof of Pininfarina. There was Andrea, myself, the stylist Felisa, and Montezemolo showed the things and asked, "Who is this guy? Who is this crazy guy that ask you to do this?" And so we explained. And there were some misfeeling toward Jim in Ferrari because of his story with the P34 that he was trying to say it was a true car, etc. So Ferrari really didn't like the story, and they really didn't like the guy. But so there was a moment of uncertainty, and then Montezemolo say, "Well, okay, let's do it. It's going to be good for the myth of Ferrari." This is the sentence that Montezemolo said. I think 1 year after, or say 18 months after, when we display the car in Paris in front of the Ferrari booth, Marchionne came in the Harley and didn't go to the Ferrari booth, but came to our booth to say this car. A lot of people at Ferrari, let's say, had a different feeling.
Well, so Montezemolo comes and looks at the car, gives it the papal blessing again, and says, "Okay, fine, it's a Ferrari." And that was, yes. That's the P45 is the only car. Is that the only car that Ferrari hasn't built? The only Ferrari that Ferrari hasn't built?
But apart of all the other cars for the salt, and
right.
No, actually, there is another one. There is another one that has never been shown. It's a one-off that I did in that time for an American client. The car has never been displayed. That is another one, yes.
You can't tell me what that is, though, right?
It's a beautiful car. If one day this client is a good friend, will decide to display it, people would be,
I mean, listen, Paolo, if your client ever wants to, just let your client know that if he ever wants to sell it for $50,000 or $60,000, I can probably find that money. I'm happy to make an offer right now. Oh, I mean, and
I will tell him.
Yeah, please pass on the message, Paolo. I will trade my XJ220 for his car. How about that? With an amazing, it's a very comfortable inside. All right.
Show me the fingers.
Yeah, look, see? No cuts, no cuts. Look, intact.
Sure.
Well, I mean, so it's so interesting because, okay, so you have this extraordinary thing. And then you are now out on your own. And we're going to talk about a car I also have a connection to because you are doing, I used to own a Stratos for years.
Good.
So finally.
You don't have a new Strat.
No, I have an old one. But you are, in your new company, you are you are now making the, I don't know what you'd call it, the new Stratos?
Yes, the new Stratos.
Okay. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Well, that has been a very important car in my career because I started, actually sold the project to Michael Stoschek as a Pininfarina manager. And then say halfway through the
Hang
project.
On, we should just explain we should explain who that is. Michael Stoschek is the, he's a German industrialist who did he come to Pininfarina and say, I want to have a Stratos recreation, or it was just an idea you came up with and said, hey, Mike, you called him up and said, hey, Michael, what about this?
You know, I'm proud that I've been working with all these incredible people, but to work with for Michael is something that very, very few people can say. Michael has been touring all Europe. He has been everywhere. He has been to ProDrive. He has been in Germany. He has been literally everywhere to see company that could build his car, his new Stratos. Okay, so he wanted to do that, and was together with another gentleman that at that time was part of the group that was owning the brand. And finally, again, there was a contact in Villa d'Este, and then he came to Pininfarina, and I met with him, I explained the process, and at the end of the meeting, he said, well, I think that maybe you can build my car. And so from there, an incredible adventure started. And half the way, as I was saying, I left Pininfarina. My Andrea died with the management. There was not a great feeling, so I decided to quit Pininfarina. And Michael hired me as his personal consultant, so I finished the car as a consultant of Michael Stoschek.
Paolo, were you involved with the initial concept of creating that new Stratos?
I don't know what you mean for concept. Let's say that they came to us with a clear idea. We want to recreate a new Stratos.
This, okay. And then when you say they, this is Michael or this is another?
That was Michael together with this other person that then during the project, let's say, was no longer involved.
Okay.
But so they came to us because their idea since the beginning was to build a few cars, not just one.
Right. Okay.
But I have to say that after two or three meetings, it was clear that there was no game. I mean, Michael is one of these person that decide what to do it, doesn't like or want to have other people involved. The development of the car was incredible because in certain area that everybody that is in this business know that there are problems. For example, the window list mechanism is something that you have to drive it from another car. So there are all small details that And because of his position as this company, he had those things developing his company. So,
well, his company did what exactly?
He is the president of Brose, that is one of the biggest, is the biggest private owned company in the world that builds part for cars.
That helps with the development. Then. Okay.
So they built all the window system for Mercedes. Okay. They have 52 plants around the world. I mean, it's one of these incredible German company. And so every time there was something that would be difficult to build in one piece, they were taking over and they were full engineering. So at the end, this car came out as the most engineered and most refined one-off that we did in my time in Pininfarina.
It's based on what Ferrari? It's based on a Ferrari, which is
430.
430,
it's based on a 430 because of the Stratos had the Ferrari engine, etc. So we try to keep also this kind of connection. And the car was amazing. Also, because of the dimension and the relation, we shortened the car of 200 millimeters, so 20 centimeters, it's quite a lot. And so all the proportion, but also all the handling, everything is completely different from the 430.
Does the handling resemble the original Stratos? Because I remember that is a car that you have to pay attention to when you're driving.
No, it's not like this. It's a car that the handling of this car is quite unique because the supercars and the hypercar in the last 10, 20 years, they have taken the path of aerodynamics. Okay, so a lot of the performance comes from the dynamic, from the downforce. The Stratos not. The Stratos, you have tons of mechanical grip because big tires, a lot of torque, aspirated engine. So something that it's fun on the circuit, but when you are on the hills here in Italy or in the mountains, there is nothing like that. I mean, to go through an hairpin, to accelerate after an hairpin, there is nothing of any of the new sports car that can.
It sounds like it's an old fashioned experience in the best possible way.
Yes, it's an old-fashioned, and honestly, we have done cars with manual transmission. We have done cars with a standard transmission. We've done cars on the Scuderia, and today I would say manual transmission, mechanical differential, and fantastic. You should come and have a ride.
You see, now you're in trouble, Paolo, because now if you say that, I would love to come and have a,
but I will also say, if you like it, you buy it.
Well, is there a special Viva Bastardo podcast discount? I mean, perhaps you could work something.
Oh, sure. You can work something.
So you're making it an addition of a number of 20 cars, is it, or more?
25.
Okay.
Yeah, we'll be at 25.
And are you watching, I would imagine you're watching with some interest the kind of, in some ways, I wonder if that was the original Resto mod. Because I had my friend Carlo Borromeo on last week. He was on, and he, I'm sure you know, he did the Lancia Futurista. So
yes.
So are you watching the kind of Resto mod world unfold with interest or not?
I was waiting for this question.
you say it like you are dreading it. we can move on to something else if you like.
No, I like to give you an answer. I think that this resto mod trend, I see it very much as a lack of imagination.
Interesting.
I think I've been very, very lucky in my life, in my career, and I I think I've lived what I consider the golden age of Pininfarina Studi Ricerca. Okay. And when you design cars, knowing the past, finding the root of certain design, but reinterpreting something and making something new. And I think a great example for me was the Maserati Quattroporte, the one designed by Pininfarina. If you are able to do cars like this, you do not need to do a resto mod. Then I understand that today we have a huge amount of cars from the past, and some of them are not very funny to drive. Okay, and we have recently done a similar work on a Testarossa. I understand that you can upgrade a certain mechanical part of the car to make it modern, or say to make it more drivable and more enjoyable. Okay, but more than that, I would not do, honestly. I think that the Stratos, the new Stratos, I think is different. It's not a resto mod. First, because we are starting from a completely different platform, and then because if you put today side by side the new Stratos and the old Stratos, is not the same car. A lot of people believe that it's much more similar than it was in reality. I tell you honestly, if you put an old Stratos without the spoiler and without the wing on the top, it looks like a Fiat 127.
really. That is sacrilege, Paolo, sacrilege.
No, the truth. And so I think we have done something very, very interesting.
Well, I think on that note, I think that's a lovely way to end the podcast, Paolo. I'm not joking. I feel like I will take you up on your offer to come and have a go in your Stratos. I would love to. I sold mine a few years ago. I still have my Lancia 037, but I miss the kind of the lunacy of the Stratos design. I mean, it wasn't for me. It wasn't the best car to drive, but it was so. I loved owning it because it was so extraordinary to look at. And I will say, yeah. I love the way you've managed to keep that kind of beautiful sort of wraparound windscreen and the proportions.
But something that I discovered, and I really never understood before having done the Stratos, is that has an incredible. It really helps in driving the car through hairpins and in twisty road, because the visibility that gives you that screen is absolutely unique.
Yeah.
Absolutely unique.
Yeah.
Nothing like this.
Are you going to be driving if I come?
Absolutely, yes.
Are you a good driver?
You take one, I take the other one.
I'm not a very good driver.
And if you lose... okay. Well, if you lose, you buy one.
If I break it, I buy it. Okay, it's a deal. Well, look, Paolo, I wanted to just say thank you so much, man. It's been such a privilege to talk to you and so lovely to hear all these extraordinary stories. So I just want to thank you for taking the time. And maybe I'll see you in the hills of Torino soon.
Whenever.
Thank you so much, man.
Good wine and good cars.
I love it.
Bye.
Thanks, Paolo.
Ciao, ciao.
Ciao.